everyone. I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour, a serious topic with serious guests. Once a week, we explore dynamics that are generally missed by the mainstream media, frequently the alternative media. Today, our program will focus upon the phenomena of conspiracy thinking and theories. I have four panelists in this order. Professor James Tracy is professor in the Department of Communications at Florida Atlantic University, where he specializes in media history and analysis, the politics of communication and the sociology behind commercial and alternative news media. He is also the editor of Democratic Communique, an affiliate of the Project Censored, and is a contributor to Censored 2013 yearbook. He received his doctorate from the University of Iowa, and recently he drew national attention for challenging the official story of about Sandy Hook shootings last month. His website is memoryholeblog.com. He will be followed by Phil Rockstro. He is a lyricist, a philosopher, who has been published extensively in anthologies. His socio-political analysis and commentaries are widely distributed on progressive news sites such as Common Dreams and Robert Perry's Consortium News, Truth Out, Counterpunch. His writings focus on the angst and alienation in post-modern society and the excesses of the hyper-capitalist consumer paradigm. He is going to be hosting a new program on the Progressive Radio Network in the near future. His website is phirockstroh.com. He will be followed by Dr. Ralph Metzner. Dr. Metzner is a psychologist, and he is a researcher. He has been one of the leading pioneers of the modern exploration school of consciousness studies. He was one of the original psychedelic researchers working with Timothy Leary and Richard Albert, also Ram Dass at Harvard University, where he later received his doctorate from Harvard. Dr. Metzner is a professor emeritus of psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he was also the former academic dean. He is the co-founder and president of the Green Earth Foundation, a nonprofit organization devoted to harmonizing the relationship between humans and the earth, and a signatory to the 9/11 Truth Statement. He has published numerous articles and many books on the psychology of consciousness and mysticism and spirituality and psychedelics. His latest book is Six Pathways of Destiny. In the Ecology of Consciousness series, he writes at greenearthfound.org. The book is Six Pathways of Destiny, and the website is greenearthfound.org. And he is followed by John Rappaport, who has worked as an investigative journalist for more than 30 years. He has very important stories that he has broken exclusively on corporatocracy, alternative health, and medical cartels, the media, and our culture. His work has appeared in LA Weekly, Spin Magazine, Stern, The Village Voice, Nexus, CBS Health Watch, and he is also an author. He hosted, produced, and wrote radio programs and has appeared as a guest on Nightline and Tony Brown's Journal, hard copy. His website is nomorefakenews.com. I welcome all of you to our program. We have a lot to share. And for those who are just joining us who may never have heard of this program, first, it is different in its format. Because we have so many people who will be downloading this program, and we have so many new listeners. In fact, our latest Google Analytics show that we have about 6,000 brand new young listeners every day. That's about 2 million per year. That's in addition to all of our regular listeners. This is a program where I do very little talking. This is more like a classroom on the air. I'll ask each of our panelists in sequence to give us their views on a particular topic, and they're not challenged by time. They can take whatever time's necessary to roll out their concepts. Now, why would we be interested at all in the phenomenon of conspiracy thinking? Because both on the right and left, The moment you bring up something that is not in alignment with official thinking and official policy, you are relegated to the extremes. Irrespective of your evidence, you can have all the science-based evidence you want, but if it doesn't match the official institutions or corporations in their statements, then you're a conspiracy nut, a conspiracy theorist. Ironic that people such as on the liberal side, Rachel Maddow or Lawrence O'Donnell or Keith Overman, disdain the so-called conspiracist. And yet, let us remind people of a few conspiracies that were absolutely positively proven and no longer are even thought of as being a non-conspiracy. The Tuskegee syphilis study from 1932 to 1972, where the U.S. Public Health Service knowingly killed hundreds of low-income African-American men because they wanted to experiment with the effects of untreated syphilis. Well, if you don't treat syphilis and becomes tertiary, the people die, and they did. But worse still, is syphilis is very easy to share. You can do it through perspiration, sweat, kissing, as well as intercourse. Now, how many of the 400 people who had syphilis that they were monitoring, how many times did they have sex? And then you create a congenital syphilis that was never discussed, it was never explored, yet they had 40 years. So just do the math. 400 people having regular relationships for 40 years. You could imagine the millions of people. Then we had the human radiation experiments, which I broke the story on in October 1989. Human radiation experiments went from 1944 to 1974. In 1995, the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments reported over a 30-year period the government sponsored, through major agencies, thousands of human radiation experiments and several hundred intentional releases of radiation. To the question of whether similar abuses occurred, again, particularly in the case of intentional releases, it was, quote, a qualified yes, according to the statements at the time and information released by Congressman Markey. I remember writing at the time about they would give radiation on toast and feed it to children who were suffering from renal disease and other diseases in a children's hospital in Chicago. There was no follow-up experiments. They merely wanted to see what would happen to the kids' kidneys. That is the mindset that pervaded that. In 1945, Operation Paperclip, the extraction of top Nazi scientists to the U.S., the Nazis' intelligent leader, Reinhard Gehlen, met with the CIA director, Alan Dulles, and Dulles and Gehlen hit it off immediately. Gehlen was a master spy for the Nazis and had infiltrated Russia with his vast Nazi intelligence network, and Dulles promised him that his whole unit would be safe and brought over. They, in turn, were responsible for MK-Ultra. Now, MK-Ultra is a CIA experiment where drugs were given to Americans without their knowledge or consent, including LSD, marijuana, barbiturates, heroin, mescaline, alcohol, and more to unsuspecting people. And, in fact, in 1973, Richard Helms, head of the CIA, deliberately destroyed all the records on MK-Ultra. Artichoke and Operation Midnight Climax. Military intelligence cleansed the files of Nazi references. By 1955, more than 760 German scientists had been granted citizenship in the United States and given a prominent position in the United States scientific community. And yet, it was all kept secret. Operation Mockingbird was a CIA project created to control the domestic and foreign media beginning in the 50s. They bribed well-known writers and journalists to write slanted propaganda. The goal was primarily to bribe writers to write about the dangers of communism and suppress any left-wing political writing. In 1976, George Bush, the new director of the CIA, announced that this activity will stop, but it continued on. And in fact, more than 1,500 journalists in the United States, including up to through today, are known to be CIA assets. Then we had Project SHAD, created by the United States Department of Defense. They intentionally exposed our military personnel with biological and chemical agents on 46 different occasions. This was done without military personnel knowledge or consent. Then you had Operation Northwoods, and it was a false flag conspiracy plan. The United States government had proposed in 1962 through the CIA and other operatives to kill innocent people and commit acts of terrorism in the United States in cities to create public support for war against Castro-led Cuba. One plan was, quote, to develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area and other Florida cities and even in Washington, end quote. That's from their own papers released under Freedom of Information Act. This operation was notable in that it included plans of hijacking and bombings followed by the use of phony evidence that would blame the terrorist acts on foreign governments. And it was drafted by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and signed by then-Chairman Lehman Lemsner and sent to the Secretary of Defense, who ultimately declined. The Gulf of Tonkin incident. It is the name given to two separate incidents involving naval forces in the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, North Vietnam, and the United States in the waters of the Gulf of Tonkin. On August 4, 1964, the U.S. government lied about warships engaging North Vietnamese vessels in combat, and in 2005, an official National Security Agency declassified report stated, quote, it is not simply that there is a different story as to what happened, it is that no attack happened that night, end quote. Well, then let us look at the latest statistics as of this afternoon. 3.4 million confirmed dead because of our incursion in South Vietnam, including 58,000 Americans. And yet, no one was ever held accountable for this false flag effort. Watergate, from 1972 to 1974. Also, most people understand about Watergate and the lies about it. There were conspiracy from Attorney General John Mitchell in the dirty tricks and funds and cover-up, along with key White House advisors, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and John Dean. Of course, more recently, we have the lies that led us into Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. Now, why is it that the media still continues to believe that the moment you talk about conspiracies and you have any evidence for it, you no longer are given any credibility or a source? That is our report. Let us begin with Professor James Tracy. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Tracy.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here.
Let us begin, if you would please, by giving us an insight as to how it is that with 9/11, all the inconsistencies with the Warren report and the Robert F. Kennedy assassination of Sirhan Sirhan being the only gunman, and on Martin Luther King, the mainstream media has never questioned any official report, not once, and none of the people in the mainstream media. Could you explain this phenomena for us?
Well, it's really an awfully big question, but it is something that I look at in my research and teaching and the writing I do outside of that. I think that it's something that you suggested in your introductory remarks. It has to do with the fact that the media are, to a large degree, a part of the establishment, if you will. The former CIA director at one point remarked that the CIA owns just about everything in the major media of any real significance, and this is something that William Casey once remarked at another CIA director remarked that he was talking about how, for example, now it's slipping my mind, but anyway, it's I think that all of these conspiracies, if one actually brings anything up, particularly someone such as myself, that's a credentialed professional, then it's very unnerving for the establishment. So you have outlets such as CNN coming out and attacking me, seeking to call my position into question, looking to have me fired, more or less, is essentially what what's taken place over the past couple of weeks. That's been my experience.
Okay, let's go to something specific. There have been many individuals who questioned the official story of the shootings at Sandy Hook. I've seen videos myself of people, at least two people being arrested, one in the woods surrounded by deputies. Why haven't we heard any of this? There's inconsistencies. No one's questioning that there were shootings. We're questioning the official story. Could you give us your perspective on this, please?
Well, I think that there are reporters that are likely there on the ground that do want to do a good job, and that was evident in, for example, the exchange with the coroner on the 15th of December, H. Wayne Carver II. I think that the reporters at that press conference realized that the medical examiner was on fairly shaky ground, but they're not allowed to actually write about that if their editors do not approve of it or condone it. I think that that's likely the dynamic that played out. The editors above them, the institutions they work for, generally just choose to highlight the sound bites and so forth, then rather than actually delve into what, for example, the medical examiner said, what, for example, was actually captured on video in the immediate aftermath of the shooting. You have two shooter suspects who are apprehended, and we don't hear from them again, and we don't hear any other questions brought up in the media.
I just thought it was interesting. The coroner said that the ballistics showed one type of wound, and yet we were told that the shooter had a gun that would have created a different type of wound. So why couldn't they get it right? You certainly have to allow for human error, but they had adequate time afterwards to correct their stories, and yet they have not. I'm concerned. Professor, please hold your thoughts. I want to jump over now to Dr. Ralph Metzner. Dr. Metzner, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What is important to me is that we would never have known about any of the conspiracies that have been uncovered if someone didn't question the official story and continued to be tenacious until they got to the truth. And then afterwards, when they found that the official spokespersons lied and used substantial resources of the government to cover it up or harass people, as they've done Dr. Tracy, wouldn't you think then that the next time that same agency is challenged, that someone might think, well, hold on, haven't you been lying to us many times, been caught lying many times? Why should we suddenly believe you all over again? Your thoughts on the whole idea of why we have such a hard time in the media and the professional class in America of accepting a challenge to the official story?
Well, we don't have free media, actually. We have a system where public media are tightly controlled and are seen as a what's technically called an aspect of propaganda. I mean, conspiracies abound. I mean, conspiracy just means a group of people, actually literally means breathing together, a group of people planning something together. So every time a board of directors or a government group gets together and plans something, or a military group gets together and plans a campaign, that's a conspiracy. They're doing something and they're not telling other people. It's businesses get together and work out their deals in secret, and to their sales campaigns and how to take over this segment or that segment of the market. And there's no particular class of events that are conspiracies, and then there's other events. This groups of people with special interests get together and they pursue their interests as best as they can. And we live in a society where so many layers of information that are tightly controlled. For example, the 9/11 stories, there's stories about the Kennedy assassination. There's voluminous literature, dozens and hundreds of books and articles and researchers who have questioned and demonstrated, with overwhelming evidence that the lone gunman shooter from the Texas Book Depository could not possibly be true. And yet that's still the official story, and anybody who questions it is a conspirator. So this is an ongoing issue, and it always has been. The state wants to control information for its purposes, and the journalists and writers and researchers are constantly engaged in a struggle to wrest information from this kind of closed system and bring it out, and they often pay a significant price for it. So the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, is an agency that operates, you know, completely secretly within its own, according to whatever it wants to do. It's not subject to any congressional or presidential oversight, and this has been going on for a long, long, long time. And you know, starting with John F. Kennedy, who made a vow and made a vow to break up the CIA and undo that. And Truman regretted that it was ever established. You know, Truman, who established it with the principle of plausible deniability, you can do whatever you want to, what you consider in the United States interest, but you know we have to be able to deny it plausibly. And later in life, Truman regretted having ever agreed to that, because what it created is a rogue agency that does what it wants and is not beholden to any legal or moral standards. And we're still living with that. And Kennedy, who tried to break it up, paid the price. You know, they got away with him. And they got away with his brother and Martin Luther King and others. And of course there were other people involved. It's not just one group. That's the way these things work. The Nazis did the same thing. It's not just one group. It's like interlocking groups of secret government agencies and semi-business government agencies that work together hand in hand, and all controlled information. Nobody knows anything except, you know, what the specific group decides you can know. And so that's the kind of situation we're in. So it's up to individual journalists and researchers to try to get the truth out about it, and often they pay a tremendous price for it.
I appreciate those insights. One follow-up question for you. When you think of Jeremy Scahill at The Nation and Seymour Hersh and Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson and the individuals throughout history, and I'll, before the show's over, I'll give you a whole list. They got inside. They had someone who told them the truth. They told the truth to the public. And yet we still refuse to acknowledge the basic lack of transparency in our right to know, especially when it impacts our well-being. For example, a good conspiracy was proven when, with FISA, we found out, again because of an investigative report, that the major telecommunications companies were giving all the private data that was requested without any search warrants, which was against the law. They broke federal law. And so what happens is that everybody got together and they voted that it's legal and therefore said no one will be held accountable. We know for a fact today that there was a separate intelligence group working inside the vice president's office, Dick Cheney. And they cherry-picked what they needed in order to create the background for the journalists to say, yes, we have to go in there and get rid of Saddam Hussein. It wasn't the CIA per se that was wrong. Their evidence showed that there was no uranium and yellow cake uranium coming out of Niger. There was no weapons of mass destruction. They'd already discredited the so-called operative who was coming forward to tell us all this out of Iraq, curveball. They had said no to him, and yet they needed a war for whatever their reasons.
Yeah.
We don't know. And so they created a war. Now you would think that with over 1.5 million people dead, 4 million people displaced, a country torn to pieces, sectarian violence everywhere, according to Joseph Stiglitz, $3 to $5 trillion, the final cost of this, that someone would be held accountable. And yet nobody will be held accountable because nobody in the media has used the words conspiracy.
But who gains? So somebody is gaining and somebody is getting rich, namely the arms manufacturers and the military establishment who, you know, get to buy and sell humongous amounts of billions of dollars of weapons while, you know, other social programs get gutted. So you look at where the money is going and where it's not going, then the pattern is very clear.
Well, something...
and the increase, the gap between, you know, the small amount of rich people and the vast population is increasing astronomically. It's higher in the United States than in any other Western country.
But how they make their money is frequently based upon a conspiracy, because they get together and they do illegal things. And if they're caught, they frequently get away with it. If you and I get caught doing anything, there's a different standard of accountability for us versus if you're wealthy, powerful, or you're an official agency.
That's right.
Does it tell us anything that there were certain absolutely positively illegal activities that occurred, including provocateur activities of infiltrating the Black Panthers and in Philadelphia actually being a part of an effort to cause a bombing and killing? And yet the FBI, not a single person was ever held accountable, not a single person was brought to justice. What does that tell us about the nature of power? When...
yes, and we still don't know who actually killed Kennedy and who was actually behind it, despite the voluminous evidence that the lone gunman up there in the Texas Book Depository couldn't possibly have been the only shooter. So just from the point of view of bullet ballistics, you know, he would have had to shoot a bullet that made U-turns and went through two bodies and came out the other side. So, so there's a huge backlog of information that's misinformation and disinformation and a kind of a black hole of stuff that's never really been looked at, not even to mention to 9/11. And
I agree.
All things have to be all cleaned up before there can be any kind of progress. You can't live with a lie, you know, where the evidence points to, you know, elements in the government itself. What kind of a public can trust the government if there's elements in the government that are, you know, operating against the good of society?
I absolutely agree, Professor Messner. Please hold your thoughts back to Professor Tracy. One more question at this time, Professor Tracy. Because you were part of Project Censored, could you give us some of what you see as some of the main conspiracies that are unfolding now that we should pay attention to?
Well, Sandy Hook may very well be one of those. There are simply a lot of unanswered questions right now. It's just happened within the past 6 weeks or so. So, you know, I would like to think that there's going to be a thorough investigation of that incident where things will be revealed, but I'm not very optimistic that that's going to take place. But that's certainly one thing. You know, there's so many, it's really rather discouraging. One could look at the phenomenon of geoengineering, which is another something, you know, disregarded as being a conspiracy theory, even though there's, you know, there are patents and so on and so forth, and there's ample evidence in our skies that something is going on we're not being told about. The radiation coming from Fukushima, that matter is not resolved. It's not going to be resolved anytime soon. It's going into the Pacific Ocean. It's going into the air. Our EPA is not adequately testing the air. Our other regulatory agencies are not adequately testing our food, our water, and so forth. So this is something that's festering and will fester for a considerable degree of time, I think.
Let me add one caveat. When it comes to genetic engineering, we just finished a major film called Seeds of Death. In that, we found that virtually all genetically engineered tests stop at 90 days. And I was curious as to why. And then the French gave us the answer. Seralini, Professor Seralini's studies with his whole group showed that the cancers in the rats fed the genetically engineered food only occurred after 90 days and continued to occur for the entire remainder of the rat's life. And therefore, you have to think, well, how in the world could all these genetic engineering companies and their scientists not have known that?
Well, I think that they probably did know it. That's why they cut off the trial at 90 days.
Yeah. Well, again, that's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
And back over something that Professor Metzner said that I would like to compliment him on, the idea to understand conspiracy as being state crimes against democracy, because that's what conspiracy is. And this entire dynamic between secrecy, whether government or business, and it being antithetical to our ideas of democracy are paramount. He is absolutely correct. How can we go forward when we've been lied to so many times by so many official agencies? Let us now bring in Phil Rockstrom. Nice to have you with us today, Phil.
Good to be here, Gary. Thank you for the privilege.
Phil, while doing a documentary last year, Death by Medicine, I decided just to see if my intuition was right. We hired a group of attorneys who spent months researching how many lawsuits have been settled in the last 20 years by A, pharmaceutical companies, and B, Wall Street banks, just those two, where they conspired to keep information secret, they engaged in illegal activities, and had to settle and pay sums of money, even if someone didn't go to jail. The numbers of lawsuits were in the hundreds of thousands. The amount of money cumulatively was in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Just one lawsuit alone, Vioxx, was $5.85 billion. 60,000 Americans died because of this drug. And the lawsuit showed that the people at the manufacturing company knew from the get-go that this could increase heart attacks and strokes, which it did. And yet they kept that from the public because they made about $24 billion. Now, there's a classical conspiracy in business, and the same companies continue to engage in these illegal activities, get caught with insider trading, price fixing, and yet their reputations are never adversely affected. You'll never see a moniker above their name saying, don't buy anything from this company, they're bad people. Could you explain to us the phenomena of corporate conspiracies and business conspiracies, not just government conspiracies, and how we refuse to acknowledge the obvious, including with all the banks that were shown to conspire, the LIBOR conspiracy, and the fixing of the subprime mortgages, and the derivative conspiracies. These were all conspiracies. And
well,
Eric, tell us about that.
Well, you know, feelings of powerlessness, as you well know, bring on depression. And to question an official storyline, power comes down on you. I mean, there's some evolutionary theory that states that depression was developed so larger alpha males would not beat up and hurt smaller males. And so, you know, we create these narratives that we internalize. I mean, that's the thing about it is that Thomas Pynchon said, if you get them answering the wrong questions, you don't have to worry about the answer. So I believe we've internalized the wrong questions. So after a time, we believe this to be true. Like, creating a narrative, creating a storyline is power. If you can get a church official, for example, in the Middle Ages to say that the bony finger of God is upon you, you peasant, and I am the vehicle by which you reach God, you have a tremendous amount of power. And the corporate hologram is as powerful that we live in with media consolidation. I mean, I rode in a cab up First Avenue today, and I had a screen of a television in front of me. As we cut west, every store had billboards in front of it and retail. I was in a full-blown consumer universe as powerful as the church of the Middle Ages. So the people who tell these tales, journalists, people that work for corporations, for example, you mentioned Robert Perry. His career was whipsawed because he questioned the official narrative of the October surprise. This is the man that, as you well know, broke the Iran-Contra story, but he went back, and when he began to study the October surprise, which was the Reagan administration having negotiations with the Iranians and to release the hostages after the election and not help Jimmy Carter's chances, when he had very strong evidence of it happening, he was told by Newsweek to drop it, and when he didn't, he was summarily fired. But his career was over. So, you know, we don't need overseers in this culture standing over our cubicles like Asvestia and Pravda and telling us what story to tell as a journalist, we've internalized the gulag. You know, we walk around with this narrative. It's as powerful as when a pagan of old walked through the woodlands and he was in the glens and glades of Pan. So we, you know, the people in that time literally believed that Pan would rush towards him. The word panic comes from Pan, literally the belief that Pan showed up in the agora and the crowd would stampede. These beliefs that we have in our head are very powerful, and when they're combined with power, it is less than propitious to one's psychological well-being in a superficial way, and it decimates one's career to challenge it.
What are some of the ones that you're concerned about? I'm assuming, I don't know, that you'd probably have a great deal of opposition to secrecy and democracy since they seem to be so opposite.
Right. I mean, just a quick anecdote. When I was 13 years old, I ran away from home and I went to the newspaper, the underground newspaper in Atlanta, Georgia, called The Great Speckled Bird. And at any given meeting of the staff there, well over half, a third of the people there were government agents acting like radicals. I would sell the newspaper on the streets, and one day I was approached by somebody who identified themselves as a journalist from Time magazine, and he took me to a local burger joint and bought me a burger and interviewed me for a story, of course, that never happened. And, of course, being a young man, I confabulated all kinds of tales about secret cells of high schoolers that I was involved with, but my family's phone was tapped for years. My mother, who was a school teacher, my father, who worked in a scrap metal yard, you know, no threat. So I know that since my earliest experiences when I was young, that we've had a government that was very terrified about the counter-narrative that developed in the 60s, whereby people in my neighborhood, working-class guys, would wander into Piedmont Park where the Allman Brothers were playing, and something very potent was happening. You know, Dwayne Allman was on stage, and people were taking LSD rituals, and you had these redneck hippies where, by four, you know, these greaser kick-ass individuals that would chase me into the park with scissors to cut my hair. When they went in there, what was called the BN was happening, and these guys, it was a seductive narrative that was drawing in America's youth. The government felt like it had to do something, so the national security state, the commercial enterprises of the country were appropriated to change the narrative, and they were able to do it very successfully, as you pointed out, by penetrating the journalistic elite, working with advertisers to usurp youth culture, and all of those things began to happen. And I think this is where the paranoia comes from. It's very important when one is dealing with any narrative to have what has been termed rigorous intuition, you know, to have an inner ability to tell your own tale in a way that you're not bamboozled by the official one. So, you know, Izzy Stone famously said governments lie, and as an earlier guest mentioned, when they get together behind closed doors and they schemed, that used to just be called a day at work. Before now, they have to act like they're responsive to the dictates of the electorate, which they're not. We, you know, our elections show what a faux democracy we live in, that whether a Democrat or a Republican is elected, we're going to get the rise of the national security state, the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex. This trajectory is going to move on no matter who's elected. So, but they have to show superficially they're listening to us. And so, hence, we get the idea of conspiracy theories, which it's just pretty much what governments and large institutions do to protect themselves and expand their interests.
I really appreciate those insights, Phil. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go over and say hello to our final panelist, John Rappaport. Hi, John.
Hi, Gary.
John, take us through what you have found in 30 years of investigative journalism. Are some of the conspiracies that once you proved them and you documented them fully, they still were never looked at or accepted?
Well, first of all, I just want to echo the idea of the narrative. This is major. People have to understand this. The central narrative that is being delivered to us by television, elite television anchors every night. This is a hypnotic trance. this is a defining of the parameters of any given story that you're going to see on the major networks in the major nightly newscasts. This is reality. And this is how far it extends, and it extends no further, and here's the conflict involved in it, and here are the two sides, et cetera, et cetera, when, of course, the actual story is something entirely different. I mean, not just, it's not the, just those two guys, it's the third guy, but I mean, the entire narrative is different. The real truth is anti-hypnotic. It wakes people up. If one of the dying media giants in this country, like the New York Times, really wanted to survive and actually, I mean, flourish, all they would have to do is to set the hounds loose on the real stories of our time and the real truth behind them and sell two or three editions of the paper out on the street every day, and people would be stealing them from other people to find out what's really going on. And they know that. I mean, I've talked to reporters, you know, over the last 30 years, we've kicked this around, and they admit it. They say, sure, we could mount a Watergate every month if we wanted to, you know, bigger than Watergate. Watergate was nothing compared to this kind of stuff.
Well,
for example,
let me be specific with you. John, let me give you one example, and then I'd like for you to expound on it, all right?
All right.
The entire premise of AIDS is based upon a single retrovirus, the HIV virus, causing 30 different conditions. And yet we don't test for the virus. We test for its antibody, which in all other science is supposed to be good, because if you have the antibody, you're protected. That's why we get vaccinated. And when I was first writing about this, people said, well, it just makes sense. But then the attacks start. Then in comes Peter Duisberg, the great the greatest scientists in American history, a professor of molecular biology, University of California, Berkeley. And then the Nobel Prize winner, who won his Nobel Prize in chemistry for discovering the PCR polymerase chain reaction, which is used in AIDS research, Dr. Kerry Mullis. Then others came, and the high prestige people, Professor Emeritus, Professor Bailey and Stronum and others, they aligned, and yet the media never once would speak to them. No official congressional investigation would speak to them. No one would debate them, even though we asked for these debates. And it grew and grew and grew. And just like 9/11 has its truth commissions, the reappraising of AIDS has a group of almost 3,000 scientists and journalists and physicians, top people from Harvard and everywhere, putting their reputation on the line by going out limb and saying, what we've been told simply doesn't make sense. It's bad science. And then we find out from an investigative journalist, Janine Roberts, she found the original article that was published in Science magazine that the entire edifice of AIDS is rest upon. That started it all. But the man who wrote the article wasn't Robert Gallo. It was his head of his national laboratory at the National Cancer Institute, and he did not find a HIV virus. He did not find that it was pathogenic, and the laboratory experiment couldn't confirm anything. And Gallo comes back. He'd been on vacation, or he had been in Europe, and he comes back, and he scribbles through this, and you see his handwriting all over it. And then he altered it and published an article that was just the opposite of the original article that that the head of his science division had written. Now, dozens of scientists signed a petition to Science magazine, rescind the article. It is fraudulent. It is not based upon accurate science, and the entire AIDS hypothesis is wrong. They refused to do that. 3,000 scientists now are against it. Have you heard about this anywhere? Has the media talked about this story at all? Not at all. They've given these people the same attention that they give the 9/11 architects or the 9/11 engineers, the 9/11, you know, attorneys. Nothing. Your thoughts, please.
Well, as you know, I wrote a book called AIDS, Inc. in 1988, which was the first book to expose the whole fraud of the HIV theory. And it was early in my career as a reporter. And so I didn't really bother to take too much notice of the fact that there was no way that we could break out into major media and cover this story once the book was published. There were some interviews that I did and so on, and I convinced certain people that they ought to think about this again. But it doesn't break through the ceiling because the narrative is so completely 180 to my findings. But think about this, because here's the test to me of a conspiracy. What would happen if tonight on the NBC Nightly News, Brian Williams says, our top story tonight, HIV is not the cause of AIDS? If he says that, and he backs it up, then the entire country goes into a complete realm of chaos, because the narrative and a whole group of narratives has been destroyed. The hypnotic trance in the viewer has been destroyed. Many institutions are now ready to jump out of windows, literally, and commit suicide if the evidence is secure, which it is and was many, many years ago. That's now you're talking about, you know, this is now, Gary, this is deep conspiracy. Because to reveal it by major media and plug it and pound on it the way the Washington Post pounded on Watergate for months, people coming out of the woodwork that we refused to talk before and suddenly confessing, you know, you got a professor from Columbia University who says, you're right, I always knew it. You know, Duesberg was right, HIV doesn't cause anything, and I kept my mouth shut for years, and then he talks, and then somebody from Harvard talks, and somebody from Yale, and pretty soon, you know, somebody at the National Cancer Institute says the whole thing was a fraud to begin with, and the drugs are killing people. Now you're talking about the reason why conspiracies stay hidden, because to break that hypnotic trance in that deeply, you now create the kind of incredibly fertile chaos in the country that needs to be created so that people can begin to wake up and realize they've been bamboozled on so many different conspiracies. And that's why the story holds. And that's why, despite all the evidence I dug up and you dug up and many other people have dug up about HIV and AIDS, that story will never be played by major media, because the chaos from their point of view would be horrific. They would no longer be the narrator telling the story of life in our times. From the earliest dawn of history on this planet, societies have had the storytellers, the priest class, whatever the class, the royal class, divinely mandated to rule. And now the storytellers are ultimately the elite media anchors who are fed their information from their, quote, reliable sources. Well, to crack that egg is to crack the entire trance of society. And that is the last thing that they will ever permit to have happen.
I appreciate those insights, John. Back to you, Dr. Metzner. When you take a look at what has just been said by John and Phil, give us a perspective of your thoughts on this. Since, and one additional element here, when an official statement is made and becomes the final word, for example, you mentioned the Warren Report or the official word on the Gulf of Tonkin that contributed to the U.S. going into Vietnam, or weapons of mass destruction, which contributed to us going into Iraq. But now we know it was all lies. And then later evidence emerges that they premeditatedly lie, so they had malice aforethought. Then what happens is, instead of going after the people that lied, they go after the people who broke the story and tried to discredit them. How do they go about doing that? Give us your perspective as a psychologist on this, and why don't we as a people see this and understand it?
Well, you know, in a way, it's very simple. The people who have power want to keep power. The people who have wealth want to keep wealth. So special interest groups, you know, control access to information, media, education, business contracts, and so anything that threatens their power, their wealth, is negated. So, but the point is, the truth, you know, truth remains truth. So, it's always possible for individual researchers to dig, and as many have done, and sometimes have paid a huge price for it. Like Gary Webb is a courageous journalist in the San Jose Mercury News who broke the real story about the murders in Los Angeles being supported by the drug agencies, and he paid the ultimate price. I mean, he was honored for breaking a fantastically important story, and then he was maligned, and he ultimately took his life because he couldn't stand the pressure. So journalists often, you know, pay a huge price, and in totalitarian countries, it's the same thing. But it's also that's also our possible salvation. You know, there's no hope in turning a gigantic juggernaut of the military-industrial complex around. That's going to continue doing what it does because it's a huge machine with unbelievable amounts of money that's churning on. But individuals here and there are able to sometimes uncover the truth and sometimes get it out, where those who can, you know, have the courage and the tenacity to look for it can see it and can take action. So you know, it's a and the same thing happened in the Soviet Union, where the system was even more tightly controlled in a way, but nevertheless, you know, the truth does come out.
It came out through gulags with Solzhenitsyn and the nuclear physicist who, along with Linus Pauling, were the ones telling us, Sakharov, that to be careful about nuclear energy. Professor Tracy, what does it feel like being on the other end of criticism when you have discovered a truth, you've discovered a conspiracy, you have your facts, you're an academic, and then there is the blowback for you being the messenger?
Well, I entered academe as a profession to, you know, have an impact on the world, I think, to kind of change the world to some degree. And I realize this experience suggests that there are limits to this particular profession in that regard. But, you know, no one is going to accept the arguments that I've put forth. Many people really just, again, they take the soundbite or the headline. They didn't really go to read what I was saying and the questions that I was raising. But at the same time, a good many individuals, I think, did do that, and so it's something that actually did, I think, you know, pique the interest and the curiosity of at least a segment of the population with regard to this this tragedy, and it did get them to question that narrative and to wake up to a certain degree. And if that's the case, then I think the price is worth it. You know, I don't know what my job status is at present, and that's really one of the things that's odd about all of this, is that how are we going to find out the truth about Sandy Hook if there's not an investigation? Because if we don't know the truth, then one cannot come at me and say, well, you're bringing up these rumors or, you know, what have you. And so that's, you know, it's sort of an odd situation to be in, but at the same time, I really have no regrets. I think that more academics should be involved in you know, pointing to controversial issues and saying, hey, our journalistic system is not performing well, our political system is dysfunctional, and you know, that's detrimental for the broader society.
Thank you very much for those thoughts. Phil, last thoughts from you, please.
Excuse me?
Final thoughts from you.
Okay. You know, we've heard a lot of talk about the official narrative. As somebody pointed out earlier, this has gone on for a long time. For example, after the Norman conquest of England, good poetry was essentially banned. The poets worked as what were called court poets. of the king, and they were, their job was to make glorious odes to the church and the king and the state. But spontaneously in the countryside, there were people, there were poets that were ill-equipped to do this by nature, and the troubadour phenomenon began to spring up. They invented the concept of romantic love, by the way. And they also came up with the Grail legends. Now, the Grail legends are interesting. They come at a time of the collapse of the official narrative. The pagan world was falling away. Christianity was being introduced. And the Grail narratives, if you look at the story, they're the bridge between the pagan paradigm and the Christian era. If you look at T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, for example, the same thing happened after the First World War, this catastrophic collapse of the elite of Europe. And Eliot's The Wasteland, it alludes to that period of where the troubadours began to tell a new narrative. So there's always hope in the problem that seems insolvable in the world, because the world is too vast for any narrative. There are so many coming about, and the most and the ones that contain authentic mythos, in other words, a really good metaphor, also resonate. So, since romantic love didn't really come into the Western imagination until the troubadours of old, there are troubadours out now creating a same narrative that, with the dynamic is so immense, the variables so huge that are involved in this, that I think, for example, that hope is a sales pitch now. So I don't mean to give anybody false hope, but there's hope inside the human heart where there's stories are created, if you're willing, as we've listened to this program, as other people are, to face the anxiety that comes with telling the truth.
I appreciate that. Phil Rockstro, Dr. Ralph Metzner, Professor James Tracy, and John Rappaport, thank you all very much for sharing some very provocative and interesting insights into the dynamic of the phenomenon of conspiracy thinking and theories.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.